Hi, welcome to Discovering Frank Big Boy Goody, exploring his half-century journey through two-thirds of jazz history, across three continents and four musical lives, told for the first time. This hour explores his years in Paris in Europe and half-decade in South America. As he traveled the world, this master musician lived at least four distinct musical lives. He was an early cornet player in Golden Age New Orleans before 1920. From 1925 to 56 in Europe, he was a jazz multi-instrumentalist, playing mainly tenor sax, except during World War II when he was in South America, playing samba and samba swing. This hour I'll be investigating his life and music in Paris between the wars and close associations with jazz musicians in Europe. I'll explore the development of early jazz in Paris and the unique expatriate community that came to be known as Harlem and Montmartre. Plus, I've got the first close-up eyewitness account of Goody in Rio de Janeiro. For inexplicable reasons, there appears to be a page missing from jazz history, and it's labeled Frank Big Boy Goody. This program and associated web pages aim to correct that oversight. The words of Mr. Goody, his friend Bill Coleman, and their contemporaries are read from books, periodicals, and memoirs this hour by Mr. Kenneth Gant, and all the music recorded in or near Paris. I'm Dave Radlauer. Welcome to Jazz Rhythm, an exploration of the lore, culture, and personalities of early jazz. After a decade playing music in New Orleans and on the road, Goody moved to Paris. He was drawn by the newly found Parisian enthusiasm for Black American jazz and the ease of finding work in the rapidly expanding market for African American music. For the next three decades, except during World War II, he worked steadily in France and Europe. Sometimes he was a freelance musician, sometimes a headlining act. He was almost always simultaneously working with the top jazz talent and most successful American impresario band leaders on the continent. Josephine Baker became the toast of Paris and launched Le Tumulte Noir, a Parisian mania for all things African American. Bricktop's famed cabaret and the bars of Montmartre drew the chic and elite of Paris, Europe, and the world. From the mid-20s well into the 30s, the Montmartre section of Paris was a Harlem-style jazz district. The shabby, formerly working-class district lit up at night with cabarets, American-style bars, and vibrant nightlife. But in 1925, when Big Boy arrived, jazz was still just getting organized in France. Before the late 20s, the music played in Paris and called jazz was pretty dismal stuff. Hopped-up ragtime marches or popular dance music. Most musicians, even the Americans, were either playing boisterous cornball, faking, or reading with little expression.
The drummer used to be in the front and had all these different things for making noises, cowbells and so forth.
Alain Romans, a very good French musician who later performed with Goody, described early jazz performance in Paris.
The drummer was the big attraction and the musicians used to be behind him on the stand. He used to throw his sticks about and sometimes even stick his tongue out. Little by little, they learned they had to make some music as well.
Gradually, as tours by the orchestras of Benny Payton, Sam Wooding, or early African-American theatrical productions of Cecil and Blake toured Europe and Paris, quite a few good musicians decided to stay. Big Boy was one of the few to arrive on his own initiative. In 1963, he told the San Francisco Examiner,
"Some American musicians were already in Europe. My brother came back from the war and told me how well musicians were doing, and that got me interested."
French musicians before the 30s generally lacked the ability to swing or improvise. So musicians who could were at a premium. With a decade playing jazz under his belt, Goody was a giant among pygmies in more ways than one, which explains why he became ubiquitous in Paris and was working simultaneously for multiple employers. With the arrival of quality musicians in the late 20s, the Montmartre Quarter rapidly transformed into a jazz mecca. The cabarets and bars all featured black and mostly black jazz bands or West Indian music. With tolerant law enforcement, an influx of African-American musicians, and the best jazz in Europe, Montmartre became a world-class entertainment destination second to none.
It was a thrilling, wide-open town,
recalled trumpet player Bill Coleman in his autobiography.
Paris had everything that New York had, and then some. The cafes, the bars stayed open 24 hours a day. Living was not expensive, the people were friendly, and a jazz musician was considered a human being.
Coleman and Goody became friends and colleagues. In Europe, as he did in each of his several musical lives, Goody quickly maneuvered himself to a position near the summit of his professional and creative environment. And within a couple of years, he was working at two of the most successful and popular night spots, Bricktop's Cabaret and Zelly's Royal Box. Zelly's was the highest profile jazz venue in Paris and a wild, boozy club. Hiring musicians was done by Gene Bullard, a big personality in the community. The former boxing champion and first World War air ace was a big man about town. He served as a kind of informal counselor and enforcer at large for African Americans in Montmartre.
People felt they had to come to Zelly's. It was the only place in Paris that was open all night, and everybody who was anybody went there.
Bullard played the drums at Zelly's, though not very well, even by his own admission. Big Boy was playing saxophone at Zelly's from about 1927 to 30, amidst other work. And besides Big Boy and Bullard on drums, the band usually consisted of trumpeter Cricket Smith, who'd been in Paris quite a while, and Glover Compton, a formidable ragtime and stride pianist in the Willie the Lion mold. Though Goody was playing alto in the early days, his tenor style was already well established when his first solos appeared on phonograph disc in 1933. Here's a little bit of scandalous detail about Zelly's, because there was kind of a scam going on. You see, there were girls who were surreptitiously employed by the club to induce patrons to buy maybe just a little bit more champagne than they otherwise might. So after the first bottle, girls were paid a cut for each additional bottle. Needless to say, a great deal of champagne was consumed. By about 1930, Bricktop's Cabaret was the main attraction in Montmartre for a chic international set of celebrities, writers, and royals. Goody played sax there for a couple of years with pianist Freddie Johnson. And it was novelist Ernest Hemingway who called her cabaret the movable feast that was Paris between the wars. Bricktop, born Ada Beatrice, Queen Victoria, Louise Virginia Smith, was a mixed-race American cabaret singer with a face full of freckles and shocking red hair. Her cabaret drew songwriters Cole Porter and Noel Coward, writer F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the Prince of Wales. Visiting jazz royalty Louis Armstrong and Fats Waller dropped in. And Bricktops was the first in Paris to headline the string jazz of Django, Grappelli, and the quintet of the Hot Club of France. The singer and barkeep had a unique talent for creating an intimate cabaret atmosphere.
Bricktop sang in a cute little voice with nice wistful tones.
Langston Hughes, the poet laureate of the Harlem Renaissance, described her unique way of creating rapport with her clientele.
She danced a few cute little steps, tossed her head and smiled, and went around to all the tables and was pleasant to everybody, from guests who could afford only one quart of champagne to those who bought a dozen bottles. French or American, tourist or diplomat, white or colored, were all the same to Brick.
Bricktop's club also played a central role in the black community of Montmartre. In the late 20s, cats hung out and jammed in the early morning hours. Musicians and black entertainers away from home could send and receive mail, catch up on gossip or find jobs. Or they could get a down-home meal of fried chicken, cooked greens, and cornbread. So an informally organized yet cohesive African-American community welcomed men like Frank Goody to Paris. As I've said, he was already playing sax at Bricktops by 1928 with Freddie Johnson. Freddie was a good piano player, and this is a lovely duet between Johnson and the trumpet player Arthur Briggs, who together ran a good swing band Big Boy worked for in the early 30s. This is Discovering Frank Big Boy Goody on Jazz Rhythm. I'm investigating his half-century journey that winds through two-thirds of jazz history. He lived four amazing musical lives on three continents. In this program and related web pages are the first comprehensive survey of his life, work, and travels, largely undocumented until now. And incidentally, a more complete biography is being written by an American living in Europe, so you're going to be hearing more about this formerly obscure artist. Still ahead, more about Harlem and Montmartre, an eyewitness account of Goody in Rio and his friendship with trumpeter Bill Coleman. Goody was tall from his youth and called Tree due to his height. Big Boy was a stage name, but he really liked to play up his size. Several musicians in books and memoirs later claimed he was 7 feet tall, and that's just not true. He was probably between 6'3 and 6'5 and over 250 pounds of pure muscle. And though Frank was a large, powerful man, he was, by all accounts, intelligent, well-educated, and resourceful. A cultured and deferential gentleman of some style and elegance. Goody had a close association with gypsy guitarist Django Reinhardt, and they were friends.
I never saw Django without his guitar. He lived for playing, and he was a wonderful person, not temperamental at all. Django had everything, feeling, soul, technique. He could be sentimental or brutal. He loved big bands, especially Ellington's. He made good money, but he always stayed with the gypsies. He was a natural genius, one of few who could succeed without training. Sidney Bechet was like that too.
Now you might notice that part of what I'm doing is setting the broader Parisian context so we can visualize this elusive expat by reconstructing his environment. So, besides being about Frank Goody in Paris, this hour is also about the Paris that Frank Goody was living in between the World Wars. So let's pause a moment from Big Boy's narrative to consider some of the fabulous women who played significant roles in Montmartre, because besides Bricktop, some of the talented African-American women living flamboyant lives in Paris included singers Florence Mills, Alberta Hunter, and Adelaide Hall. And a couple of the more amazing women were trumpet player Valeda Snow and, of course, Josephine Baker. Valeda Snow was an excellent African-American trumpet player in the Louis Armstrong mode. Glamorous and showbiz savvy, Snow was embraced by Paris. In the 1936 publication Jazz Hot declared,
"We had the pleasure of finding in Valeda the temperament of the great black trumpeters. One is obliged to admire the fullness of her tone,
and the power that no European can even approach.
Arriving in the mid-30s, she made Paris her base of operations as she toured the continent and recorded in London. She lived the expat life to the hilt, flaunting an opulent, even decadent lifestyle. But unfortunately, Valeda's sad internment during World War II, complicated by drug possession charges, was one of the worst for any Black American performer. Snow barely escaped alive. But of course, no discussion of Black Paris would be complete without Josephine Baker. Her 1925 and 1926 appearances in Revue Negre and Folies Bergères were an unparalleled sensation in Europe. And Baker thereby launched a French mania for all things African-American, summed up in the phrase, le tumult noir, the Black tumult. Her semi-nude, highly sensuous dancing became associated in the Paris mind with jazz. But her vast success actually had little to do with her singing, which was neither jazz nor blues, but a melange of cabaret, popular song, and music hall theatrical. Baker's genius lay in staging glittering spectacles. One Paris observer described her dazzling 1930 extravaganza.
Excellent imported British dancing choruses of both sexes, a complete Russian ballet, trained pigeons, a live cheetah, roller skaters, the prettiest Venetian set of the century, a marvelous first act finale, acres of fine costumes, the four best can-can dancers in captivity, and an aerial ballet of heavy Italian ladies careening about on wires. The show even contains long glimpses of the beautiful Baker. She has, alas, almost become a little lady. On that lovely animal visage lies now a sad look, not of captivity, but of dawning intelligence. Janet Flannery, Paris was yesterday.
Josephine's remarkable achievements during the next half century included being the first African-American female to star in a major motion picture, Zuzu, in 1934, assisting the French resistance, for which she was decorated, and becoming a campaigner for civil and human rights of international stature. No American was ever more beloved by the French nation than Josephine Baker. It's doubtful that men like Goody could have flourished as they did in France without the tumult launched by Josephine Baker or nurtured by Bricktop and the other women of Harlem and Montmartre. You'll find more about these fabulous Parisian divas at the Jazz Rhythm website, www.jazzhotbigstep.com. This is Discovering Frank Goody, an expat American jazz musician who lived in Europe for three decades. He was in Paris from 1925 until just before the Second World War. And he went to South America for the duration, then returned to Europe and resumed playing music in France, Switzerland, and finally Berlin, before moving back to the United States in the mid-50s. Next time, I'll give you an intimate view of Goody in San Francisco from rare, never previously broadcast performance tapes and interview clips with musicians who knew him around 1960. Because most of the black Americans living in Paris were employed in entertainment, it was usually early morning before their jobs were done. They collected after work at American-style bars or in tiny cabarets like Bricktops. In his memoir, Goody's friend, trumpet player Bill Coleman, fondly remembered the friendships among African-American musicians at, for instance,
the bar and Hotel Lejeune, where many of the American musicians would congregate when they had finished their night's work.
Daytimes for most musicians in Montmartre consisted of endless hanging around in bars, cafes, billiard rooms, or the corner tobacco and postage stamp vendors where musicians often met. Coleman noted,
between Boudon's and Lejeune's was a little Harlem in the early morning when all the night spots were closed. The American musicians and entertainers gathered in those bars and tobacco stores with the tabac signs.
Some of the favorite spots to hang out were a joint called The Flea Pit and Boudon's Cafe. That popular cafe was even memorialized in trombone player Dickie Wells' Langerous Hanging Around Boudon. It's got a scat vocal by Bill Coleman and Django Reinhardt guitar. Even Sidney Bechet's biographer John Chilton notes that a large part of the jazz life for most Americans in Paris was sitting about, gossiping, gambling, and drinking. But some musicians weren't impressed by what they saw in Montmartre. Like clarinet player Albert Nicholas. He complained,
the musicians that I saw in Paris were just hanging around and playing corn, gambling amongst each other.
But I suspect that the ever-productive and always enterprising Mr. Goody would have been less tempted by booze, gambling, and gossip than most, except as it might have aided him in finding work. And if his music income ever ran thin, the resourceful big boy always had his upholstery trade and other ventures to fall back on. The man always had a knack for engaging in multiple simultaneous enterprises. As for relaxation or diversion, Big Boy might have just as easily been drawn to Bullard's Athletic Club, operated by our old friend, nightclub operator, and drummer Gene Bullard. Catering to the elite of Paris and to the African-American community of Montmartre, it was the most popular of many gyms. And they were, in fact, a popular antidote to the partying and hard living of Paris, an attempt to balance the champagne-soaked nights with exercise, massage, or some training in boxing. And as I've suggested, Frank Goody was a remarkable physical specimen. Massive, solid, and strong. He definitely liked to stay in shape and probably even did some sparring. And in fact, he told a musician I know that he'd been a boxer. In the early 30s, as the economic depression began to bite, Montmartre nightlife fell off. The decline was hastened by the spread of drugs, prostitution, and street crime. And a local Corsican mafia was shaking down cabaret operators for protection money. The downside of allowing a thriving Harlem-style jazz district finally provoked a strong reaction from the formerly tolerant inhabitants and the authorities. After 1933, between protests from out-of-work French musicians and tightening regulations, performance of African-American jazz was curtailed in Montmartre. But by that time, many of the top musicians like Goody had begun finding more prestigious venues outside Montmartre, outside Paris, on the French Riviera, or in Monte Carlo. There was work in Belgium, Holland, and the Low Countries. Portugal, Spain, and Germany. Some set off touring Egypt, Istanbul, Bombay, and beyond. And before long, other developments, like Paris discovering Django, and then the specter of German occupation, finished off a unique cultural era. Wow, that was a heck of a band that Freddie Johnson was running in 1933. Frank Goody knew that chart and was in that band, but not on that recording of Harlem Bound, a fine original written by Freddie Johnson. And we've heard several tracks by that band that he co-led with the fine trumpet player you've heard, Arthur Briggs. Notable, by the way, was the presence of African-American expat trombone player Herb Fleming. And like Goody, Fleming arrived in 1925, worked widely in Europe, and spent some time in Latin America. A versatile musician, Fleming led a group for Josephine Baker's 1930 review, noted earlier, and went on to play in Italy, India, Ceylon, Shanghai, and Berlin before returning to America in 37. But he went back to Europe in the 60s. This is Discovering Frank Big Boy Goody, exploring his life in Paris and South America during World War II, and still ahead this hour, the massive influence of Coleman Hawkins on all the European tenor saxophonists, and previously unknown details of Big Boy's life in Rio de Janeiro. I'm Dave Redlauer. Thanks for being with me. You'll find more about Goody and early jazz at the Jazz Rhythm website, www.jazzhotbigstep.com. Now, studying this guy for a while, several things have become apparent. He was always a dedicated professional musician. He was all business, and yet eager for the late-night, early-morning jam session. He was resourceful, enterprising, cultured and intelligent, sober and yet pleasant to be around. A complete gentleman. During possibly the end of 35, but certainly during 1936 and 37, Goody was working in the large swing orchestra of Willie Lewis. Lewis was a singer, clarinet, and alto player, but his real talent was successfully running the only all-African-American swing orchestra in Europe. During the early 30s, Lewis had gradually built up his popularity, and after recruiting several good musicians directly from America, he relaunched at a swank, high-society venue in Paris, Chez Florence, with a Saturday night radio broadcast heard across the continent. until 1940, Willie Lewis and his entertainers was the most formidable and successful swing ensemble in Europe. Frank Goody played tenor sax and some clarinet on about half their 24 records. A good solid swing band, it had several notable soloists, outstanding piano man Herman Chittison, who'd recently toured the continent with Louis Armstrong, and a very good but little-known alto saxophonist, George Johnson. Written by their arranger, Swingin' for a Swiss Miss featured several of the band's other fine soloists, including trumpet players Bill Coleman and Jack Butler, and Frank Goody on tenor sax. For Frank Goody, the orchestra's Belgian tour of summer 1937 must have been a great jazz holiday. For one thing, he probably ran into his old buddy, Freddie Johnson, who was having great success in Belgium and Amsterdam and recording with Coleman Hawkins. And Frank got to hear and jam with the tenor saxophone master, Coleman Hawkins, his greatest inspiration. And as I've suggested, Big Boy's tenor style was strongly influenced by Hawkins' tone, rhythm, and phrasing. Writer, broadcaster, and soprano saxophone player Richard Hadlock knew him as a fellow musician in California and interviewed Goody in 1963.
He told me once that he was very inspired by the visit of Coleman Hawkins to Europe. A lesser man might have said, well, when Hawkins' star went up in Europe, mine went down, you know, and be kind of petty about it. But not Frank. He said, you know, I listened to Hawkins in an all-night session. He played Stardust for half an hour and never repeated himself. He said, I learned a lot from him. It was a fantastic experience.
Coleman Hawkins, Stardust, 1935, Django Reinhardt guitar. Grappelli on piano. It's clear that Goody's tenor style was mostly drawn from Coleman Hawkins, and that was not unusual, especially in Europe, where Hawkins was living from 1934 to 39.
We had never heard anything like it. Everybody went wild, and all the tenor saxophonists changed their styles to sound like him.
And you need to understand that Hawkins was the first great soloist of the saxophone. And Hawk's complete mastery of the instrument and innovative style reversed the magnetic fields of jazz.
He could create beautiful melodies, and he was much better in person than on the records.
Hawkins made the saxophone itself a contender for lead instrument, second to none. Focusing his extended improvisations on the harmonic structure of a song, Hawkins laid the predicate for modern jazz. And speaking of Hawkins, decades later, his usual reticence fell away. Frank placed him in a rare category.
Oh, Hawk? The man was just champion of the world, that's all. tenor saxo champion du monde. He showed everybody how to play that damn thing.
Coleman Hawkins with pianist Freddie Johnson in Holland, 1938.